for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. North Korea's ruling dynasty is preparing for transition after the death of Kim Jong-il. In accordance with his father's succession plan, his third and youngest son, Kim Jong-un, is the new leader of North Korea. Joining me to talk about what this news means from nuclear-armed North Korea may and what it may mean for the region and the world, Doug Paul of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Sarah Yun of the Korean Economic Institute, Jonathan Pollock of the Brookings Institution, and joining us from Minneapolis, Eben Ramstead. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, we do invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, Eben, I'm going to start with you. Since we know so little about what goes on in North Korea, do you have any questions about how Kim Jong-il died or even when he died?
Well, I guess I would say that I sort of take the North Korean regime at their word at the details of this. Of course, I guess we could always have some suspicion. It is a government-run, state-run, very tightly controlled news organization, and they are, they don't ask questions. There's not going to be any kind of inquiry about an autopsy or inquest or anything like that. But they did come out and say that he died of a heart attack. He was on a train. They didn't say where he was going or anything like that. They just said he was out of the capital. It's always typical that they release his schedule or say where he's been a few days after he's been someplace. And so on Friday or Saturday, the state media there issued these statements that he had been at some events on Thursday in the Capitol. So it does sort of fit. I mean, it's not inconsistent, in other words, that he was traveling because, there was no inconsistency in the other reporting that was done.
And, Eben, I know you left South Korea just prior to that time. You missed quite a story.
I've been based in South Korea for 5 years, and I have to say this is the story I've been waiting for, and I flew out for the holiday. Our plan was for me to have the holiday this week and for my assistant to have the holiday next week, and I would be back next Monday, but it just worked out that I happened to miss the biggest story. But it worked out actually quite well because I was able to work with my editors on U.S. hours very well and do things like this.
So how much do we know about the succession of Kim Jong-il's son? What do we know about him? And had he actually been named by his father to succeed him?
Well, there's no sort of formal name. There's no sort of formal inauguration. This is something that came up with my editors. Is will there be some kind of formal event like a coronation or some kind of thing like that? Instead, what it is kind of the bestowing of titles at certain moments. And the big moment in his case came in late September last year when there was a big political conference organized, and it was pretty much organized for this purpose, where he was given a military title first, and then a political title a day or two later, which kind of shows you the order of priorities there. And at the same time, there were similar titles bestowed on Kim Jong-il's sister, her husband, and a general who has been considered close to the family and now has really emerged as, quite super close to the family. And he's been in a lot of pictures of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un together in the past year or so. So we really see this as kind of now maybe a collective or a little protectorate around Kim Jong-un. But what we don't know at all is we know this organization, but we don't really know what they think or what their ideas are or where they might be headed right now. Maybe nowhere in the immediate short term, but, you know, for the next few weeks after the mourning period, you know, we're going to be watching very closely what they say and do.
And that is the voice of Evan Ramstad. He's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. I want to ask you, Evan, how you have, over the 5 years you've been there, gotten your information about what's happening in North Korea while you were based in South Korea.
Well, I always say that it's kind of like the way we cover business anyway. It is, businesses put out statements every day, and then you also call businesses and talk to first PR people and then executives. In North Korea's case, you do watch a steady stream of announcements by the state media, and then you sort of mix that in with reporting that comes from informal sources, a lot of them having to do with, web-based newspapers that are run by defector groups or NGOs or organizations that do some dealings with North Korea. Some of the dealings have to do with economic exchange, but a lot of them have to do with, like, humanitarian kind of stuff. There's, for instance, a very reputable organization, sort of Buddhist-oriented, called Good Friends, and they get a lot of just little reports out. And so you sort of look at all these, and some of them, of course, you have to just throw out because they sort of seem very extreme, but it's all good to sort of study, and you start to see patterns and things like this, and you start to see, what seems worthy and what doesn't seem worthy.
All right. And turning to you now, Sarah Yun, we've heard reports about demonstrations in South Korea. What does this change in regime mean for South Koreans?
I think that's a very important question. The reaction in South Korea has been, to me personally, surprising. There are demonstrations and there are oppositions, a little bit of chaos, but surprisingly, in my opinion, the South Korean government and the Korean people have handled it very well, with a lot of calmness and a lot of caution. So, for example, as soon as the South Korean government learned of the news of Kim Jong-il's death, they called emergency meetings on cabinet level, ministry levels, all throughout the government, and decided on next steps. Now, granted that some of them may have been blindsided, but given that the fact that they may have been blindsided, they were still very quick to act. And President Lee Myung-bak was very, he emphasized a lot on the importance of stability and peace and the importance of the South Korean economy to continue to go and continue to grow in the midst of this this chaos and the shock.
And it's interesting that Sarah uses the word blindsided. Even the United States, Jonathan Pollock, seemed to have been blindsided by Kim Jong-il's death.
I'm always reminded of Ambassador Boland's admonition when Churchill talked about the Soviet Union being a mystery inside an enigma and so forth. He always said it's not a mystery, it's just a secret. This is perhaps the most controlled system on Earth. It excludes the outside world. There is a minimal diplomatic presence in North Korea, especially of Western embassies. We don't have any of the standard channels and means by which we elicit information, and that's what we're struggling against. This, not for the first time.
And Doug Paul, what do we know about Kim Jong-un?
Well, we know precious little. The U.S. government, after he ascended to his new title 15 months ago, went out to try to find the students who knew him at a Swiss boarding school and interview every single one of them. And they came back with sparse information about him being a bit tyrannical, difficult, but also being a fan of sports and other things you've seen reported.
How old is he?
Well, approximately 28, but 28. No one's really in a position to say for sure. Kim Jong-il, who just passed away, is also said to have been 69, but probably 70.
Yeah. And with that kind of schooling in Switzerland, how do you believe, I mean, that's part of the Western world. How might that have shaped his approach to the world in general?
Well, I think it may have shaped it a lot. He may also be one of the most plugged-in people in North Korea to what's happening in the outside world through the Internet, through access to international telecommunications of various sorts. We just don't know what he has, and we'll have to watch it unfold going forward. But I think a more relevant concern is, what are the fissures in society, and how do they get stressed as we go forward with this new untested leader trying to prove himself to those other factions
and
in the government?
Most especially to the military.
Military and the security forces. There's a bodyguard force, a party elite, and a governmental elite. I would say the military, since the father had emphasized the military first, the military would come first in the ranking order of those elites.
I was going to say that a lot of North Korean politics at a presentational level is very, very symbolic. I would not preclude a scenario where Kim Jong-un is the nominal leader, but that there are other powers that are much more influential behind the scenes.
Interesting. Jonathan Pollack, he's at the Brookings Institution. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls. And we're back talking about North Korea, the death of Kim Jong-il, his apparent successor, Kim Jong-un. However, as we have said in the first part of this program, knowing as little as we do about what goes on inside North Korea, much is yet to be revealed. We're joined now by Robert Gallucci. He's president of the MacArthur Foundation. As Assistant Secretary of State, he was the lead negotiator in the Clinton administration's 1994 agreed framework with North Korea. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. To what extent do you believe that this succession offers the U.S. an opportunity?
I think it might well be an opportunity that we continue as we seem to have been before Kim Jong-il's death, to head in the direction of some bilateral talks once again aimed at North Korean nuclear weapons program. I think we should stand ready to proceed with those talks if the North is is still up for them, still interested. As I understand, at least what's been reported in the press about the terms for those talks, they sounded reasonable to me. There'd be a freeze in the North Korean enrichment program and the activities at Yongbyon, and we would meet and talk about, among other things, how we would get to a point of dismantlement and the end of that nuclear weapons program. So that is should be a central focus of ours in this, as well as the stability on the peninsula and the concerns of our allies in Tokyo and Seoul.
How does our position today compare to what it was back in 1994? Vis-a-vis the North Koreans?
Well, interestingly, we were in the midst of the negotiations. I was in Geneva when Kim Il-sung died, and South Korean foreign minister woke me up and told me that had happened. It was something of a surprise, and that there was Kim Jong-il. At the time, we weren't exactly sure what role the son was playing, but there was a theory that he was actually quite important and had been for some time the driver behind those talks, and I think that is the conventional wisdom now. This is not like that. This young man has not been in close to power for that long. He is substantially younger, obviously, and untested. So I think there's lots more... indeterminate about the current situation than there was then, though I would remind everyone that there was a pretty good debate that raged for months as Kim Jong-il took his time in taking on the positions of power, and some argued that meant that there was going to be much more of a corporate leadership. Others pointed out that in Korean society there was great respect for the father when he dies, and waiting a year would be quite reasonable. The second seemed to, I think, was more nearly correct than the first.
So how would you currently describe our strategic objective with North Korea?
Well, I think our first interest really needs to be to stabilize the situation on the peninsula, remain stable, that whatever, and a number of people pointed out that the son may be looking for opportunities to demonstrate his strength domestically, internally, as well as for a foreign policy audience. And we shouldn't overreact, but we shouldn't be passive either. If there is any acting out by the North Koreans, our hope is there won't be.
What kind of acting out are you talking about?
Well, we've witnessed, remember, we are now in the wake of the sinking of a South Korean ship, of the shelling of South Korean island. Both of these caused deaths to South Koreans, and I don't think domestically a South Korean population is in a very tolerant mood with respect to North Korea. So we really want to avoid a near-term conventional crisis of some kind that turns into a military crisis. That's, I think, an immediate concern that we are interested in stability and working with the Chinese, maybe as in the first instance, but also with our allies in Seoul and Tokyo. Our core interest here, in addition to stability on the peninsula and avoiding war, is to manage that nuclear weapons program and ultimately manage it into non-existence. That's not an easy thing, and some would argue it's not even a plausible thing. But I think that has to be the goal. If there were instability of some kind, what would happen to those nuclear weapons? Who would control the fissile material? All those questions would be extremely important, because our vulnerability as a nation, it's not so much from a direct threat of North Korea mating weapons with missiles, but the availability of nuclear material to terrorist groups and the possibility of a terrorist detonation of a device in the United States. So transfer, leakage, all those kind of words that go to that this material and these weapons have to be our central focus.
And finally, what about the role of China in this sort of midway point, as the young man is trying to establish himself not only with the military but security forces?
I think that the Chinese role is key here. How much the Chinese want to coordinate with us, I think, will be an open question. Certainly, they have some intersecting interests with us. I wouldn't call them congruent interests, but intersecting. They do not wish to see an increase in American political and military presence in Northeast Asia, so they don't want an instability that would bring us in. So we share the objective of making sure that we don't end up in any kind of crisis on the peninsula. But how exactly the Chinese will manage all the uncertainties, which I suspect they see in the North as we do. I think they have a much better window into the dynamics of the politics in the North than we do, but they can't be too settled about the outcomes either. So I would say a close coordination with Beijing, to the extent that the Chinese are interested in that, would be in our best interest.
And the final thing that probably might be in our best interest from your perspective, for the U.S. to play it cool?
I think that we should be stand ready to continue those negotiations, or to continue the effort to establish the negotiations with the North. We should be prepared if it turns out that we would go into a larger negotiating context, the so-called six parties. But the real work for us is going to be done at a bilateral level, and it'll be very important that the Chinese support this. The Chinese, more than anyone else, have had influence in the North. The Chinese military, the party, and this whatever the leadership is with Kim Jong-un and the family, they will all be very sensitive to the Chinese perspective, and we must be as well.
Robert Gallucci is president of the MacArthur Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And turning to you, Doug Pohl, how has, in your view, the United States handled this passing, this transition thus far?
It's been a steady and cool approach to it. It's the right approach, in my view. The administration will find a way to express condolences for the loss of the leader and stay in touch with them to the limited extent we have head of state contacts from time to time. And we also ought to do, as Bob Gallucci just suggested, keep our negotiators talking to their counterparts to the extent that they're willing to talk. But we have a little more to do than that, I think. Behind the scenes, over the last more than a decade, the U.S. and the ROK governments and institutions in those countries have repeatedly done games on different scenarios for just this kind of eventuality. And some of these games have shown the situation deteriorates very rapidly. So we have to be standing on our toes. We want not to give military signals through surprising pre-positioning of forces and things like that that might send the wrong message. On the other hand, we have to be ready to respond to crises as they erupt.
And, of course, we have, 50,000 troops along the border? Am I stating that incorrectly,
yes,
Jonathan?
Yes, our troop presence is a little under 30,000.
30,000.
It's still very significant.
Yeah, I should say. And what would you say about that troop presence in this interim period?
Well, in fact, what we have been doing is repositioning our forces, deploying them farther south on the peninsula, not making them disappear by any means. We hold all kinds of exercises where we bring in additional forces at various times of the year. But I think what we've been trying to do is to prepare much more fully for contingencies that don't fit in the standard playbook, if you will, precisely because of the uncertainties and unknowns about what North Korea might do under various circumstances, their use of special forces and so forth.
And it has been said that Kim Jong-il left a significant unfinished agenda. Tell us about that, Jonathan Pollack.
Following up on what Bob Gallucci said before, one other big difference from 1994 is North Korea is now a state in explicit possession of nuclear weapons. They are the only state to renege on their commitments under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they claim equal standing as a nuclear state, and they may now have two separate means by which they can enrich, either enrich uranium or reprocess plutonium for their nuclear weapons program. So the difficulties there are compounded hugely. Kim seemed to be seeking, toward the end of his life, yet again, some kind of a door to Washington, some kind of a means by which there would be direct contact. But he dies with that, obviously, very, very incomplete. Indeed, I'd say his whole legacy is one of just trying to keep the system afloat with real uncertainty and indecision on his part about how to proceed in any particular area. That's what we are stuck with, or left with, if you will, and we have to decide whether or not and how we might quietly signal some kind of an interest in renewed contact with the North.
And what about the South, Sarah? If we proceed in that way very quietly, how would you see the South reacting?
Well, I think the South Korean government is going to take a two-track approach, building up the military and on high alert without high publicity, not to create, to avoid tension or visible tension on the peninsula, but at the same time trying to have reform strategy, reformed relations with North Korea, given the situation. So I think that's the approach that the South Korean government will try to take. Now, it's going to be difficult because North Korea is going to be looking internally, most likely, for the next year because of the succession process and the transition process, and also next year, 2012, being their achievement for strong and prosperous nation. So South Korea is really going to have to try an outlet or an opening or a gap to engage with North Korea without compromising any of those previous situations, such as the Cheonan incident, the Yeonpyeong incidents that happened.
Sarah Yun, she is with the Korean Economic Institute, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones at this point, 800-433-8850. First to Inverness, Florida. Good morning, Pete. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. This is really a privilege. I think the administration has shown remarkable restraint by resisting the temptation to gloat over the death of a man who was, you know, frankly speaking, a brutal dictator. And I think this leaves the door open for a new relationship with his son and the other members of the new regime. Rather than calling North Korea an evil empire, we've been quiet and we've paid our proper respects as we would with the passing of any head of state. And I think the only thing I would say that in disagreement with the panel, I think this would give us a better opportunity for six-party talks and avoid a bilateral situation, because maybe the new regime would be more open to including China, Russia, South Korea, et cetera. And thank you very much, Diane.
Thank you. Doug Paul.
Well, the speaker, the questioner just asked about the bilateral path as opposed to six-party talks. Actually, bilateral talks are always necessary to get results in these frameworks. In the current instance, the bilateral talks are to get us back to pre-existing commitments in order to resume the six-party talks. And there was an expectation as late as last week within high ranks of the administration that perhaps in February or March of next year we would be ready for a return to six-party talks. Now that's an open question whether that can be achieved on that timetable. I can't rule it out, but can't say it's like more likely either.
And what about his comments regarding the Obama administration's handling, its remarks, its approach to reaction to the leader's death?
Well, everybody today has talked about the need for stability. Our first responsibility as a government is to our own people in South Korea and to the people of South Korea who are our allies. And provocative gestures, seeing this as a moment to exploit, to bring down the regime, could rain artillery down on the 20 million people who live in Seoul. And that would be our responsibility if we were to have done that.
So you would agree then with the caller that thus far the United States has dealt with this well?
Yes, I agree.
All right, let's go to Alan in Annapolis, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to talk on your show. I've been listening for many, many, many years.
Thank you.
I have more of a practical question. I'm wondering, as I listen to the events since since the death of the leader of North Korea. Why is it that the military and the educated class of people in North Korea stand by and allow this Kim family to rule the country for so many years, as if they had some kind of God-given right to do that?
It's an interesting question, Jonathan Pollack. How would you respond?
I think it reflects the remarkable, if improbable, history of this system, going back to Kim Il-sung, who ruled the North for almost a half century. He acquired a capacity to, if you will, brand the system well before we talked about branding. A man of charisma, keen intelligence, capacity for manipulation, he built a system around a small cadre of loyal lieutenants, many of them related by blood, and sustained it for a very, very long time. I know it seems improbable, but this is an extraordinarily controlled system.
Jonathan Pollack, he's Senior Fellow on Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Short break, and when we come back, more of your comments and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCOhost databases. By Cabot Creamery Cooperative, 5 generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. And by ESET, offering home internet security with parental controls to fight spam, viruses, and cybercrime. ESET.com. This is NPR.
She was billed as the most beautiful woman in the world, but 40s star Hedy Lamarr was also a brilliant inventor. How she contributed to the development of today's wireless technology. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as we continue our discussion about the succession in North Korea, Evan, I'd be interested in your reaction to our caller's question about why the North Koreans tolerate this kind of handoff to a relative, or do they?
Oops.
No.
And everything that we were expecting, you know, that we saw in the Middle East this year. But Jonathan is exactly right about what his father did. But I think more practically what we see has developed there is, first of all, the use of threat, the fear that if you get out of line with the regime, you will get tossed into a labor camp or something like that. Second of all, a kind of a two-tier economy has developed. The remnants of the old centralized distribution has now kind of morphed into what we would call like the royal economy or kind of the court economy. This is what the elites have, and they get sort of patronage and they get gifts and everything, but they also get to do the things like make deals with the Chinese and run the import-export companies to make the basic things run. Meanwhile, there's the kind of general economy which the masses have to subsist through. And this is, works because a lot of people outside of Pyongyang just sort of subsist on food that is grown either in farms that they are associated with or relatives are associated with or friends are associated with. They have a very poor existence, but they can survive. And so that is kind of the overall mix of things.
And the question of just how much poverty, how much hunger actually exists in North Korea, is that something we can know, Doug Paul?
Well, we recently had a survey done by the World Food Program to investigate some of the provincial conditions, and they do find a general lack of nutrition. It's endemic with North Korea. It's never going to produce the food it needs. The food used to come from South Korea when it was a unified peninsula, and they need to have an effective economy so they can buy the food they need. And periodically, of course, they're also experiencing disasters, floods and droughts that reduce their limited capacity to produce grain and other foods anyway.
So would you say that there is a sufficient amount of food to go around for the population of North Korea, and is it fairly distributed?
I would say in answer to both questions, no. They make sure they take care of the 600 or so thousand people in the elite, as Evan just mentioned. And then if there's more left over for the others, that's a good thing. In a year when you want to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung, you'd like to have more, so they're looking for food from outside right now. But they don't really work to make that a steady... they don't make the reforms necessary to have a steady supply of good food.
All right, to West Newbury, Vermont. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning, Diane. I have a comment on some aspect which hasn't really been mentioned very much. One talks about the DPRK as being totally closed off. However, there is, I believe, a relatively large elite which has had contact with the outside. I personally have been to North Korea 5 times working with the Korean Democratic Women's Union, which is a governmental organization, and have had 2 delegations of Korean women, North Korean women in Switzerland. I feel that there are a lot more people in the elite who know the situation outside of North Korea than one really thinks. And a side comment, one group, the delegation that was with me for 10 days in Switzerland in September, did mention for me for the first time Kim Il-un as being the Kim Jong-un as being the successor.
Anita, I'd be interested in your view as to just how powerful or not the women of North Korea actually are.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
I'm interested in just how powerful you believe the women of North Korea are.
I don't think they're very powerful. I think that the people in power are the men. The head of the Korean Democratic Women's Union is automatically a member of the Supreme People's Council, but I don't think any of those people have much power at all.
Would you agree with that, Sarah?
I would generally agree. One indicator of that is a lot of defectors, North Korean defectors, have been around 70% women. And that is an indication that men and women are both starting to work. So in that sense, they are both in the workforce. But the reason that women are working is because of poverty, because of lack of food. So they're forced to go out and find work, and oftentimes they're forced to go out and find work across the border in China. So they defect and then in return send money back to China. So they are facing difficult circumstances.
Jonathan Pollack.
Yes, the paradox, if you will, raised by our caller from Vermont is apt. But in an ironic way, it may, if anything, the knowledge of some within the elites of the outside world may be precisely what inhibits their efforts to open up the system more, to keep it as channeled as possible. Because I think within the elite, there is probably a keen recognition that if the doors truly open, if information spreads, if individuals spread, if the mythology that has been built up around this regime now for more than 60 years erodes significantly within the population as a whole, then the future of the system will be in grave jeopardy.
Evan Ramstead, how much of a purge are we likely to see with the transition?
Well, it's tough to say. Already we've seen some. You know, as I mentioned at the start, we've discussed Kim Jong-un became public, was sort of formally revealed to the North Korean public in September last year at this big political conference. After that, there was a series of sort of forced resignations of high-level military people on both the National Defense Commission, which is the top sort of organ of all, and a couple of other sort of lower-level military groups. And that is sort of recognized as kind of a start of this, you know, shaking up of the you know, the elite and the people that kind of form the inner circle. It's really hard, though, from outside to know exactly,
sure,
you know, how extensive this could get now.
Doug Paul.
Well, he's right. The big divisions in the society probably are generational, between the army and the party, and between the elites around the Kim family and the broader elite. And if large groups of these people start to see their self-preservation under threat, they'll do what they need to do. So it's really important for someone like this new leader to pick his fights carefully and not to take on large swaths of personnel in his system, or he could find the system come back after him.
How carefully do you mean?
I mean, for example, Evan just mentioned the removal of several of the military senior commanders. If he were to take a whole class of commanders out, or take out a whole generation of them, then I would see them banding together to protect themselves.
Interesting. All right, to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Mark.
Hello there.
Hi.
I think I'm correct in understanding that one of the Republican presidential candidates, Ron Paul, should he be elected and become commander-in-chief, would remove all of our forces, including all of our troops, from the Korean Peninsula. And in the highly unlikely scenario that would happen, what would be the most likely response of not only the North Korean government to our removing all of our forces, but also to the South Korean government and, for that matter, Japan?
What do you think, Jonathan Pollock?
Well, I think the odds of there being a President Paul are pretty small. This kind of an issue has reared its head from time to time. People wondering, South Korea is perhaps the 12th biggest economy in the world. Can't they defend themselves and so forth? We have long-term commitments to South Korea. These date, of course, from the Korean War itself, when the United States seemed to declare South Korea outside the U.S. defense periphery, and we saw what happened. I think under the existing circumstances, there have been some changes and modifications in the U.S. presence, but the fundamental reality of having North Korea as the world's most militarized system, deployed very far forward with ballistic missiles, with long-range artillery, is that prudence alone does not dictate or permit the withdrawal of American forces under any circumstances as obtained at present.
And Evan, I know you'd like to add.
I'd just like to add that the troop presence of the United States in South Korea is half borne by the South Koreans. And, you know, that cost is shared. And so, you know, the generals in who are there for the U.S. always talk about this moment every year when South Korea makes a big payment to the United States.
Well, you know, we did try this once. When Jimmy Carter was elected, he had promised in his campaign to remove the troops from South Korea, and it had set things back politically in South Korea. It caused the dictator at that time to really claw people in, and the administration's internal intelligence and military analysts had to carefully and persistently persuade the president that what he was trying to do would be unwise and dangerous.
Jonathan Pollock, what do we know for certain about North Korea's nuclear capability?
Well, the best we can say is we can estimate that probably they have an existing inventory of 4 to 8 nuclear devices. Whether they can actually mount any of these devices hypothetically on a missile and deliver them, whether to Japan or elsewhere, we can't really know for certain. But we do know that over the course of persistent negotiation and so forth, North Korea has never yielded any of its nuclear assets. It's that very uncertainty, for reasons in part related to what Bob Gallucci said before, fears about that there might be transfer of some of these technologies or materials, but more generally the fact that they do indeed over time have a capacity to build up some kind of a capability, whether it is a true operational capability or simply more a symbolic or political force, I think is still an open question. But some of the trends are worrisome. They retain options, and they continue to pursue them, many of them utterly unverifiable, and it really ought to cause us great concern.
Sarah, I want to turn for a moment to North Korea's relationship with China and their commercial dealings. Can you talk about that?
Sure. China and North Korea has had a steady flow of trade relations in the past many years, but especially in 2010, after the sinking of the Cheonan and the shelling of Yeonpyeong Island, the South Korean government almost entirely stopped any aid or trade relations with North Korea. Therefore, China has filled in that gap. And China is using this as an advantage and a leverage point to have more of a footprint in the borders and within North Korea. And I think China's first move since Kim Jong-il died is very interesting because they were the first ones to come out. They were the first movers to say, express official condolences and also recognize Kim Jong-un as a future leader. And in that, they're trying to be the most influential and continue to have economic and strategic and people-to-people relations with North Korea. And I think this is an interesting and an important challenge for the South Korean government as well as the U.S., how they're going to deal with this Chinese increasing imprint in North Korea.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What is it that China provides to North Korea?
Well, they are the biggest provider of fuel and food, mostly. And as a trade-off, North Korea gives them a lot of natural resources, such as iron and coal. And also, China, in return, has received the warm water port, and that's where they're developing the Rasan district right now, and also some of the port areas and the borderline areas. So it's a mutual relationship.
Doug Paul, at this point, what do you believe that the U.S. should be doing?
Well, this is something I've been urging for quite a long time, and I think it's more urgent now than ever. At the very highest level, we need to have our leader contact the Chinese leader and appoint people who can get together and talk in great confidence, away from any cameras or microphones, about what we would do and what we would not do in the event of certain contingencies in North Korea. We need to give each other reassurances about our future behavior, because these are now matters of potentially pressing concern.
And do you believe that should be the Secretary of State?
If I were doing it, it would probably be the head of CIA on the American side and a counterpart on the Chinese side, people who have a known habit of keeping themselves out of the limelight.
Jonathan Pollock, what about you? What should the U.S. do now?
Well, it's both a list of what to do and what not to do, as one of the callers noted. We need to be very, very mindful of what we don't understand fully. I do think it does call for some kind of a measured public statement that leaves the door open to an extent. But I agree with Doug. We should try. But frankly, the record with China and China's own willingness to engage in any private discussions, perhaps in part because they figure that sooner or later any American is going to leak or disclose what goes on, is something that they are unprepared to deal with. I must say that the North Koreans follow what the Chinese do with incredible closeness. This is a deeply suspicious system, and when we know from statements, comments from Chinese officials that the North Koreans do complain about statements, even when Chinese say things that they deem politically incorrect.
And Evan Ramstad, last word from you.
Just add very quickly that it's significant that overnight tonight, over the past 12 hours, China did make a statement acknowledging that they have talked at the Foreign Minister, Secretary of State level, that they held talks with Secretary of State Clinton. That's significant in that it sends a signal to North Korea that, you know, there is a dialogue going on. It wasn't just the U.S. saying, we talked to China. China actually said, hey, we talked to the U.S.
Evan Ramstad, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Jonathan Pollack at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of a book titled No Exit, North Korea, Nuclear Weapons and International Security. Sarah Yoon, she's at the Korean Economic Institute, and Doug Paul of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from